Welcome to another edition of the War on the Rocks podcast series. And this is actually, I always say it's a very special edition of the War on the Rocks podcast series, but this is very special for two reasons. One, it's the first we're doing about a piece of fiction. And two, it is the first that we're professionally recording, courtesy of the New America Foundation. So I just want to thank the New America Foundation, where Peter works. And I'm here with Peter Singer and August Cole, August of the Atlantic Council and Peter Singer of the New America Foundation. So thanks for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this new book you have coming out, Ghost Fleet. I read it. It's very exciting. It's called Ghost Fleet, A Novel of the Next World War. And why don't you tell us what you were trying to do with this? Because this is a bit of a departure from what you guys have done in your careers.
So a novel is an unusual way to approach some of the bigger questions in national security, but we both have, I think since we were young, really loved reading the books that Tom Clancy put out in his early days and felt like that gave us a lot of perspective on and informing our kind of understanding of you know, international relations, of security. And you walk that forward and you look at a lot of the challenges that are in today's defense realm, and you need to reach a lot of people to really help figure them out. And fiction is one of the best ways to do that.
In many ways, it's a novel, but it's also a smash up with the fields that we all come out of as well in current affairs and national security. So it's a techno thriller, as August mentioned, in the vein of a Tom Clancy. Red Storm Rising was very much an inspiration of looking at the, back then Clancy looked at the what if the Cold War turned hot, and rather than following a single character, multiple location, multiple characters and spaces, et cetera. And so that was a bit of an inspiration. So we're looking at the current trends of the what if China and the United States, if our brewing Cold War ever turned hot, similarly falling multiple locations. But this, of course, there's a nonfiction side to it. This is a real concern. And so it's a novel smashed up where it's got 400 endnotes, every single technology in it, every single trend, even some of the quotes that characters say are drawn from the real world. And I think that hit our I would describe it like a double goal. We wanted to write something that echoed back to the books that we loved when we grew up reading. And again, you know, whether it's the Clancy's or Herman Wouk or World War Z was another inspiration, Game of Thrones, et cetera. You can see these formats. But also the format of the fiction, a lot like wargaming in the real world, allows you to dial the clock forward a little bit and explore the what ifs. So the Chinese Navy is on pace to match the U.S. in warships, and according to the U.S. Naval War College, match it in quality in the late 2020s. Okay, what does that world look like? Or we've seen cyber conflict in terms of, you know, stealing Hollywood scripts, stealing Social Security numbers from OPM. But okay, what does it really look like when it's crossed with warfare? So that's the format allows you to explore these different what ifs. And along the way, we poke a little holes at certain assumptions and debates that are out there, and everything from counterinsurgency theory to autonomous robotics, you name it.
A novel also takes concepts and ideas that could be academic and makes them really relatable through characters. And I think when you look at the way the story is built around different points of view, how you consider what political regime might come next in China after the Communist Party, well, that's something that is a big part of the book. And also we can see that then through the eyes of a general in that army. You know, what is life like in an occupied territory in the 21st century? That you can experience that through those who are living through it. And I feel like that is the kind of narrative that we relate to and remember almost better than some of the more traditional approaches to that. You know, we want to write a book that people will tell each other about, like, and refer to the characters as launching off points to have bigger conversations.
Could you guys tell us how far into the 21st century does this start? And if you're, I don't know how much you want to disclose or want to keep secret at this point still, but what does the world look like at this point in the future?
So we deliberately did not put a specific date on it. Mm-hmm. So it's not tomorrow, but it's not multiple generations out. Some people have you can date certain things maybe by certain weapon systems that are under construction now, and then go, okay, well, if they're operating in this world, then they've been delivered. So, you know, I don't want to say it's 2023 or no, it's 2027 or whatever, but you can get a flavor of kind of the period that we're looking at. Another way of putting it is, you had the Arthur C. Clarke, you know, anything a generation beyond a generation is in the world of magic. We're not playing in the world of magic. Our rule was no magic, no Klingon space power packs. Every single technology in it has to be drawn from either current systems or a system that is already at prototype stage or R&D. You know, so there has to be, for example, a contract announcement from DARPA. There has to be pictures of it that have surfaced on Chinese websites or whatever. But certain aspects of the world that are there that we play with, you know, again, on the geopolitical side, the U.S. Has become an energy superpower. And so one of the what ifs is, how do we conduct ourselves in a world where we're an energy exporter? And will we do so responsibly? These are the sort of, we're just now entering this question right now. The U.S. military is committed to certain weapon systems that we're on the train towards right now, but maybe they aren't the best for either low intensity or high intensity conflict. That may be one of the real world lessons from the experience of writing the book is, we buy a lot of programs right now that I jokingly call the Pontiac Aztecs of war. If you remember the Pontiac Aztec, it was sports car in the front, minivan in the middle, SUV on the back. It tried to be all things to all people. And the result was that it was over-engineered.
So maybe you're talking about the F-35.
I'm not naming any names. You know, it's not just over-engineered. It's over-promised and over-priced. You mentioned one of them. There's ones at sea, et cetera. And so one of the things we play with in the book is go, okay, well, you know, to use the F-35 over, according to DARPA reports, over 80% of the microchips, parts of them are made in China or Taiwan. What does it mean to go to war when your chips are made by someone else? Or, you know, August, when he was at Wall Street Journal, broke the story of the F-35 program being hacked. Okay, what does that mean? Or a different example would be the LCS, the Navy's own tester said it's not designed to be survivable in actual combat.
Which is a funny thing for a
So we do the remarkable, you know, what if of what if this fingers crossed strategy didn't work out and you actually entered into battle with it? And it wasn't just us theorizing it. We went around interviewing the various real world equivalents of the people who might fight in a World War III. So everything from Navy captain of a destroyer. What would be, you know, what not just what would you do, but what are you thinking in these scenarios to F-22 fighter pilots, to Chinese generals, to some of the unexpected folks who play a role in war, Silicon Valley venture capitalists, anonymous hackers, you name it.
I mean, you can think and write about a lot of these concepts, whether it's the hacking or penetration of a major U.S. military network. But understanding really what it means in a wartime sense, I think, is one of the leaps that are really hard to make. And that also there's the technical side. There's also almost the anthropological side. You know, what would a cross-generation war effort look like, where you have digital natives teaming with people, with Americans whose skill sets are more in the 90s, which in a sense is the olden days. So that was one of the big questions.
That was tough for us as writers to move it forward and then realize we might be the old fogies in the scenario.
Yeah, I mean, we probably have more in common with the older characters in our book than the younger. And I think that is something, again, that is often often overlooked. You know, it's easy if you're in a certain lane within the military, the government, to look at your program and how it fits into a bigger picture. But to actually step back and understand that larger picture is really, really important. And it's very hard to do in a way that will get someone to read, you know, more than 400 pages of nonfiction, but they might read 400 pages of fiction and hopefully enjoy it, maybe at the beach, maybe with a beer. The idea being that they can come away from that and have a different conversation when they're done about what the future of war looks like.
And I think you guys really pull it off, and it really is fun to read. I'm going to press you on it one more time, and if you don't answer it, that's fine. We'll move on to the next one. But what does the world look like? What introduce the story. What's
So the world is essentially take current trends today and move them forward just a little bit. So we have a world in which China has truly risen. So it's no longer the discourse of what if China has the first or second most powerful economy. It does, to not just, oh, they're starting an arms buildup. You know, in the real world, which nation bought the most warships and warplanes in 2012? China. Which nation in 2013? China. Which nation in 2014? China. Which is planning to do so for 2015, 2016, 2017? So we go, okay, let's move that forward. So you're seeing a China that is more powerful than today, kind of finally seeing itself as a superpower. As August mentioned earlier, though, in our scenario, the Communist Party may not be along for the ride. And there's been a lot of discussion of this in the real world, and usually it goes in two veins, which frankly I think are not realistic. It's either, oh, Communist Party will always be around, or there'll be no Communist Party and China will somehow become something, you know, a democracy and everything positive. And instead, in our scenario, which, you know, I think is more arguably more realistic, essentially you have a more professional Chinese military and a more confident and successful technocratic elite who essentially kind of team up to focus on stability there. You've got that. You have, as I mentioned, the geopolitics of certain alliances that are being sorely tested for the United States.
This is a really important point, I think, from a real politic, war on the rocks perspective, from the realist point of view, is to really understand how our allies view the value of our alliances, particularly when they might be tested most. I think there's a lot of assumptions built around that need to be explored and played with in a way that actually makes us think, well, if we really had to go to a war in a big war context, who would be with us and what would that be like?
Yeah, so I mean, just today, as we're recording this, NATO came out with its report on who's spending what, and only five nations out of all of NATO are even making the minimal 2% defense budget target. And those five nations are the U.S., Estonia, Poland, Greece, which is, you know, crazy to think about, in the UK, which is really not making it. But more importantly, you have this, okay, what if there was a conflict in Asia? Do you think NATO is really going to be along for the ride, let alone contributing at this level? Or how will certain states in Asia think about this? So you've got those playing out. You've got domestic trends. Some of the technology, you know, we play with is whether it's military technology to consumer technology move forward. One of the fun things for August and I was going around and playing with the prototypes of what looms. So, you know, I've got photos of him using smart rings, which is basically the next generation of how we'll control our computers. Think of it as like a computer mouse on your finger.
Right. Augmented reality is a big one. Virtual reality too. You know, we take that, what we saw kind of emerge with Google Glass and then recede. You know, the tide is going to come back in. At some point, and that will have.
Could you tell us what the Viz glasses are? Because I think that was that's what I like about how you guys handle technology is, sort of a lot of successful movies have done this. Well, not always good movies, but successful in terms like Minority Report and how they envisioned what computers would look like in automatic cars, and we're starting to see that now. I feel like you guys pulled that off, a very similar thing with the Viz glasses, with the drones, the rings. I read just the other day, and since I read the book, I've seen these things like, oh, these are being developed. You know, just how you can move your fingers to control something now, or that Google, I think, is working on that.
I mean,
the
Viz glass concept is really interesting if you think about it less as a clunky overlay on your experience like you would have at a 3D movie theater, but rather something that's more integrated into the way you look, the way your eye moves, the way you process information at like a neurological level. That's what we're talking about. And so it's not something that is, you know, really the domain of just one company, but you would have it developed in along the lines of like the sports sunglasses market. So, you know, Oakley might make one, and then you might have, you know, a tech company making another, but those sorts of disparate points of view on how that technology works all come together around this kind of common standard. And so you can have a conversation, a podcast like this, and you can have it recorded essentially in perpetuity. So think about the implications of a generation that grows up without really having to remember anything because it's all stored in the cloud, so they speak through their Viz glass.
And also the whole idea of it, and again, this is matched in the real world where Google Glass or whatever was headed, is not just having it overlaid on the glass that you're looking through, but it's beamed into your eye. And as was mentioned, whether it's tracking your eyeball movement to literally beamed into, so you're processing it, that changes the experience, where not only is it, the idea is that it's easier to digest information, but also it's going to make it very hard at times to tell when reality and what your experience, what your eyeball is telling you is reality. And so there's, again, there's a little sci-fi side to this, but it will play out in the real world. And this isn't just us theorizing. And as was mentioned, it's being worked on at everything from the Googles of the world to there's an Israeli defense company that's basically for Israeli infantry. That's the vision of the future. To circle back, it does, though, illustrate the question that you asked earlier of, what's the date? One of the reasons why we're reticent to put an exact date on it is that things move so quickly and or slowly that to put an exact date would be the, one way for setting up for fall. So another way of putting it is there are certain technologies that we thought might be a decade out, and yet things are moving quicker and we're seeing them sooner. And so that, you're mentioning, I already saw things like that and we're like, wow, we wrote the book 18 months ago and we're already seeing it happen. But the other part of it is the real world is moving too quickly. So, to not ruin the book, I'll just mention the opening scene. The opening scene of the book is a U.S. Navy P-8 surveillance plane being angrily ordered away by a Chinese military officer over radio. So, you reading this, you may have read the book like 2 months ago, would have said, this is like in the 2020s, except in the real world, that happened in the South China Sea 3 weeks ago. And so we're like, the problem is the real world sometimes is catching up to the fiction, which of course changes the work from being, we don't want certain parts of it to be a work of prediction. If that makes sense. You don't want a novel of the next world war to come right on the biggest level.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the interesting things about this book, and you sort of mentioned the genre and I guess your literary influences, is you have a lot of different characters in a lot of different parts of the globe and you're sort of jumping around, but you pulled it off in a very, very effective way. It's very seamless. How did you, particularly as co-authors, so you don't just have one person with this vision in your head, how did you plan the plot structure out? Did you have to have diagrams? Did you have to, have note cards or some sort of link diagram to keep all these pieces in your head? How did this work out? We put on these special headsets
that connect us from... No, I mean, a lot of it started with the kind of basic conversation about the world we were building, and we layered it on. I mean, that I think was reflected how we actually wrote it too. But Pete had a kernel of an idea that we grew and grew and grew, and it was very additive in that sense, reflecting I think our own reading, our own experiences in the work world, doing related but different things, coming at them from different perspectives.
We joke, but the writing process was a lot like one of the key technologies in the book, which is 3D printing, where you take something, you design a fairly complex structure, and then the next person takes that, layers over it, builds it bigger, but then also shaves it, changes certain things. Then it comes back to the other person, layers on top of it, changes the design, layers it. So it wasn't the traditional approach of you write this chapter, I'll write this chapter, you write this chapter, I'll write this chapter, and then we bring it together.
That wouldn't have worked, I think, for what we were trying to do.
You lose the voices. But so it built out in that way. And then, fortunately for us, we share, we learn along the way. We love the same kind of books and experiences. And, so sometimes as I mentioned, the characters were drawn from real world people that either one of us or often both of us knew. And then also meetings with these people.
So people that we might know from around town.
No, but there's amalgams or whatever. Sure. So the example would be it follows a group, this question of what if America's veterans learned from the last 10 years of wars in the sandbox? And, we ask this question of people and we know these people. And so, but then, and it's not what have they learned and how to fight against an insurgency, but what are the tricks of the trade they might use against someone else that we've picked up? To be, you know, and so, which, you know, gives you a really cool storyline, et cetera. But then in turn, we're taking that and marrying it with the fiction that we loved. And so someone might hear that and go, oh, you mean like, you know, the season of Battlestar Galactica, where they're basically fighting the insurgency. And we're like, yeah, you know, guilty as charged. We love that, and that's fine. The really interesting thing to me was how sometimes people think we were pulling from the real world and we were actually maybe inspired more by the fiction. So the example of that is the there's a character who's essentially a serial killer that's using the context of war to hide out in. And the nonfiction reason for doing that character is it allows you to explore, you know, how might you still carry out your deeds in a world of overwhelming surveillance of, you know, Gorgon stare drones to DNA tracking, all the things, how much you still get away with it. But in the fiction side is her inspiration was, you know, in large part books and the TV show Dexter, where you're put in this really uncomfortable feeling of, am I cheering for a serial killer or not? Mm-hmm. There's also a John Steinbeck novel that's set in World War II that plays with this idea of, you know, when you're carrying out the killing in war, what are the reasons for it? But to go back to the weird thing is later on, one of the military reviewers of it, you know, we shared the book to get feedback on making sure we're getting things right, not just the early interviews. One of the military reviewers of it thought we were inspired by this one particular insurgent in Iraq who was this, who, you know, basically the U.S. for a while thought they were an insurgent and then for the politics, and then they couldn't understand certain things that were happening, and then they ultimately figured out, no, this dude was just a straight-out murderer, pathologic, and that was the explanation.
I never heard about that guy.
Well, the biggest hint was that he was killing people with drills instead of gunshots, and in one case with a stone. And it's to get kind of gross for war, but it's war on the rocks. But the point was that he was the military reviewer was firmly convinced we'd gotten the idea from this individual, and we're like, oh yeah, no, not.
Yeah, I think to kind of pull back too, and you know, War on the Rocks is a place that devotes a lot of energy to the editing and the kind of the writing, the quality, certainly. And kind of pulling back and thinking about process too, you know, when you try to take on something as big, and this is new ground for us, neither of us have published a novel before, having a really good plan. And we spent a lot of time coming up with a pretty strong outline, I think, that we worked from. But yet, as you write, as you get to know your characters, as you get to spend time in that world. You know, I could sit down at my dining room table where I wrote a lot of the book, but I wasn't really there. I was somewhere else, right? And that experience you spend with those characters in that other place lets you see that maybe your initial idea for a scene was wrong, or you have a character who just has to go a different route and their relationship needs to change. We also had a really good editor, it has to be said too, who guided us quite well through a really, I think, potentially treacherous part of the book, which was the character development.
And that's actually raised though, because you're in the role of an editor on War of the Rocks, and it was fascinating to me. It's a very different experience with your editor on this cross of nonfiction and fiction than the normal side. So with a nonfiction book, you know, typically there's, you know, the battle is mainly over things like, you know, word count and, oh, you didn't express this as most powerfully as you could. With fiction, you have this, you know, oh, this scene isn't working for me, or this character, I don't like them. And you're like, no, I love them. And it's you feel like it's a little bit more subjective. And then the other part of it is, you know, the structure of the book by it being these multiple scenes and characters is a lot like, you know, I describe it as like, when it got to the editing process, like Jenga, because if you tweak one piece in one scene, it might make that scene crisper, but it has repercussions 50 pages later in some other scene. And so you had to be, that was to me, maybe more difficult than the writing of the book was the editing process. The one last thing that was kind of funny that War on the Rocks people might enjoy is how there was the editor is not from you know, our world of national security. And there are certain things that he would push back on. And, you know, we'd be like, actually, no, that really is the way it is. You know, so the example of, you know, you made a joke about F-35. So, you know, not to give anything away, but in the opening scene of an F-35 pilot, he's complaining about how the gun's not working. And, you know, for the editor, he's like, you know, oh, this is silly. And we're like, actually.
Yeah, it might not
and
work.
And I joke, we didn't have the heart to tell him that the bombs don't fit the bomb bay either. But, you know, that's well beyond, that's too strange for fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a question, too, of how much detail do you put in a book like this? You know, you don't want to write something that is like a catalog, like recitation of future technologies and with wrapped around a few characters. And so I think that was part of the tension too, was figuring out what is the right level of detail so you're kind of pulling people towards you the whole time rather than giving them a third of the book and them just saying, I think I've had enough. I can't literally process any more information. And that's why I think it effectively became very a fast-paced book because we like to read that, but also you're just trying to take people to so many different places around the world in this story.
Yeah. And for whether we get the trends or technologies right at the end of the day, it's going to be judged by a large part and maybe even a majority of the readers by just simply, you know, I don't care about F-35, counterinsurgency, electromagnetic railguns. I just want a fun read while I'm sitting by the pool. And that to us was always the goal. You know, you will walk away from it knowing how an electromagnetic railgun works, but it's only to serve the purpose of that scene.
I think you, and I said this at a not too, I mean, a sort of recent event that I was at with August at the Atlantic Council, is that I think what this book does really well is, you know, obviously you make some sort of, you're not making predictions, but you project out a possible future of what the world looks like politically. But, and that may or may not happen, but that is also just sort of not important. I think what you do very well is point out what combat and operations and concepts of operations might look like. So in addition to having a really interesting, fun story that I do think people will enjoy reading by the pool, just, you know, regular people that don't live in Washington and are better off for it. But but also, I mean, I would really recommend anyone that's interested in a career in the military or in the defense space pick this up, because it's really some of the more useful kind of futuristic thinking, rather than saying in 100 years Poland's going to be a great power, like George Friedman style stuff, just to pick on him, which I don't think is useful and probably not accurate either. This is actually, I think, a much more way of thinking about the future in terms of defense. So congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So this experience writing fiction, do you guys want to do it again? Should we expect a sequel?
the novel of the next World War?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we definitely enjoyed the process of it, you know, both the writing and working together, but also, you know, dialing the time forward and exploring these different trends. I certainly learned a great deal from it. And in turn, you know, the book comes out, we're taping this about a week before the book comes out, but it's already having impact on the real world. And that's been really instructive to me, a little bit, you know, both heartening and disheartening, and that so early review copies made their way across to the Pentagon, and a series of senior leaders have already read it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it hits what we were talking about before, you know, to in many cases, it seems a staffer or the like was like, you know, hey, sir, you know, you're on the plane, read this, you know, instead, you know, sadly, they're more likely to read a novel than a think tank edited volume. But the result is a wider readership, but it's also many of the ideas and lessons in the book are starting to influence real world policy and everything from strategy debates to certain things that are going to happen with certain technology. And that's been really instructive. Another way of putting it is, I know of certain people who said they read my nonfiction books, who really didn't, who have definitely read the novel. So that's been interesting to see. And maybe that points to, again, you know, August's work in, at Atlantic Council of the power of the cross between fiction and nonfiction, but also leads me to maybe think there's things we can explore more in that space.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot more we can do. And the book, I think, is a good test to some extent whether there's an appetite for the kind of fiction that is enjoyable but also can help start a debate or at least be thought-provoking in a meaningful way. And so I definitely see us doing more together because it is important to enjoy it because it's hard enough on its own, just a task like this. And it's been a really good teamwork and collaboration.
And with this world war that you paint, there's so many theaters that you either touch on briefly or don't touch on.
That's one of the
it
hardest.
Seems like there could be little short stories
parts,
that come off of this.
Of the book is kind of making peace with the fact you just have to leave a lot of the world, you know, the reader in the dark for a lot of the world that would be so fascinating. You know, points of view, you know, looking at, you know, the effects of the insurgency from a child's perspective as one, or, you know, looking at the war from a European's perspective, but, you know, through the conflict itself, you know, someone who's more of a detached observer like de Tocqueville in his tour of America, you know, a long time ago. I think there is that potential.
Yeah. And, you know, again, you're set within the confines of the story, you know, the optimal length for it, but also to circle back to both, you know, you want to keep the pace fast and interesting. As well, the nonfiction point, you know, for us was also to illustrate the differences between the conflicts of today and what a future conflict, particularly one involving great powers. And so, you know, that also drove the choice of hitting these different domains. You know, so what would a real cyber war look like? What would real air, you know, the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force have obviously been incredibly active in conflict, but they haven't fought against a peer since 1945. So what would that look like? But again, that then leads you to have to, you know, there's certain things you're just not going to be able to cover, nor should you cover in this space. It also hits a little bit of what you were saying before. You know, it's not trying to predict the future. It's trying to lay out a variety of futures that potentially lie ahead of us. But at the end of the day, it's a work of fiction. Its job is, you know, to both, you know, hopefully it informs, but it also has to entertain.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the more people that read it, the more impact it has, you know, and that's, I think, where that entertainment piece comes in.
But it isn't, you know, what it's funny to, you know, you and I sit here and talk in front of the microphones about it. The decision to have a novel with 400 endnotes is a huge experiment in this space. You know, the most that I personally have seen of this were, you know, either the kind of Lord of the Rings style where the footnotes give you even more fictional history, you know, Deogard is the great grandnephew of Beogard or whatever, or it's the Michael Crichton style at the end. These are, you know, 25 books or journal articles that inform me. Our format is, you know, it's the way we would write our nonfiction books. It's, you know, footnote or endnote to the specific page number, you know, and it's a huge experiment. And now that we've done it, you know, we had a big debate on whether it would be a massive turnoff for people, and we're getting the exact opposite. And I can't even believe that we were debating it. But, you know, at the time, it was a big debate between the two of us and the editor as to whether to do that.
I like the way you did it, because if you did have those big Lord of the Rings style footnotes, I think those are actually make it really hard to get through the book, is where, like, you having to read all this exposition in footnotes, whereas you just cited, you know, the real debates or the real things or the technology. I think that is a much more smooth experience.
And it allows you to situate it in the real world. So, you know, if you are interested in learning more about it, oh, this is where they got the information from, which is why we have, you know, in notes and nonfiction books, to it situates it in terms of the policy relevance, to finally it guards us from any claims that we revealed classified information. Nope, sorry, it's already out there in the open. It's just a matter of mining it, and that might be anything from how certain American weapon systems have already been hacked to you want to understand the next Chinese carrier. Yes, there's a secret discussion of it, but we were able to pull together things that have surfaced at everything from Chinese military trade shows to selfies that were taken in Chinese harbors that then in the background you can see the carrier under construction. That's and then funny. You can marry that up with Google Earth.
Well, it's good to know they're just as narcissistic as we are.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, but the point is that, you know, sometimes you, the information seems really, really super top secret and it's out in the open either through, you know, boring contract announcements or what we think of as, you know, open source data mining, which again, you know, I think back to Clancy and Red Storm Rising. He reveals, so to speak, the stealth plane 2 years before it's officially revealed by the Air Force. And that was neat back then. You know, I remember that as a reader being like, oh, wow, we're able to do this, but document it. But it also goes back to, I don't know how he did all that, you know, in the pre-internet
age. It's really impressive, yeah. I mean, I think too, you know, there's the writer's perspective on a book and trying to get someone to read it is sort of your abiding challenge. And I think the conversation that you're having either implicitly or literally explicitly with somebody, you know, as they're talking to you about your book is, you know, let's invite you to read this story that I've created. And I think the footnotes are a good defense against someone who says, I don't read fiction. And then, you know, I literally have said this to somebody, but I've got almost 400 endnotes here. You know, this is not your ordinary fiction. It's going to read differently. And if you like nonfiction, or maybe tell me why you like nonfiction, then I can tell you that this book will, you know, this is the salesmanship aspect of being a writer that I think is really important. And to some extent, I think that footnotes have really helped in that regard.
And if you only like fiction, well, guess what? They're endnotes. So you never have
you
to look
skip
at them.
Yeah.
<That's> right. You can just stop right. at the end of the text and you'll never see them.
There are a lot of characters in this book. I'd like to hear from each of you what your favorite characters to write were.
Mm.
I mean, I liked writing working on the serial killer because it was such an uncomfortable experience. And there was some surfing involved, which kind of brought me back to the surfing I used to do. But no, but in seriousness, I mean, I think there's a father-son relationship in there. And the father character is, I think, drawn from some of the my grandfathers who had sort of maritime backgrounds and were tough. And I drew a lot, I think, on that character and their kind of experience, you know, with lives at sea and kind of doing hard work.
So I'm going to cheat and say you can't, you know, it's like identifying, you know, your children. I mean, you're not going to say that, but I'm going to cheat and say by scenes. So there's one scene to me that was the most fun to write, and the character that is at the center of it is essentially this billionaire who, you know, is an amalgam of certain real world billionaires who decides to play a role in the war. And it's just an incredibly fun, entertaining scene, but also fits with, you know, I've met many of these types and, you know, it hews to reality and the kind of, you know, both brilliance but also outrageousness of the ideas. And then in turn, that scene is what led August and I to become the proud owners to the rights of a 1970s Alice Cooper space opera. And if that sounds completely bizarre and makes no sense, you know, as August, you have to read the book.
Yeah.
It does work. The scene that was the most, or scene slash character that was the most powerful or kind of emotionally taxing to write is with the Conan character, who's a Marine aviator. She's on the run behind enemy lines, and there's a certain reveal of it that it literally had me writing it with you know, almost tears in my eye. And, you know, I can't give more away, but it's kind of, mm-hmm. it's an emotional punch to the stomach. And that was it. So it's a very different experience of reading how those things play out. And that's, again, you know, the choice of rather than following a single character is it allows you to give different emotions, different reactions. And, you know, the reality is just like, you know, I don't know, people who read Harry Potter to Game of Thrones, people are going to identify or connect to different characters in ways that, you know, hopefully they will, of, you know, this is my favorite versus the ones that we identify.
There's an element, I think, in this book that when I try to think about what is this book really about, I mean, there's this whole aspect of destiny, and you see that in the characters, that what does war reveal about our killer in Hawaii or this father-son relationship? You know, it changes people fundamentally and allows for them to be different people than they were. It's also about destiny in the national sense, China's, America's. And I think so that it has this kind of macro but also micro level, and that each of those characters is another way of considering that question, which I think is really important to do, because it, again, takes away from steps back from the technology, steps back from a lot of the kind of more wonky sides of what we usually do in our day-to-day lives, and lets us kind of get at these really core questions of humanity and in conflict.
And there's a character who essentially says certain things that reveal this question of destiny, and really about how there are situations where you may think you have a choice, and the very fact that you think you have a choice reveals that you don't have a choice. And kind of he's speaking both on kind of a geopolitical level to his own personal level. And in many ways, he's echoing back to, you know, certain things that Mahan wrote about, you know, and to America's idea of manifest destiny and the like. But the point is, you also have this, you know, you're asking, you know, favorite characters. You still hope it's grounded in the real world. And so there's certain things that characters do that you as a writer may not like, or certain things that they say, but you're hewing to reality. So as an illustration, there's a Chinese military character who is often going back to lessons from, rather than Mahan, to Sun Tzu. And people go, oh, you know, is that really, like, yes. And if you've ever, it's been, you know, we actually footnote that to a Joint Forces Quarterly article that talked about this phenomena, to our own experiences of meeting with officers. And, you know, you're often in building a character when you're linking to the real world, you're not just looking at, you know, things that they say, you're looking at what history do they mention,
and how they think about the world.
Yeah, you know, what is the points in history that they mention, and what does that reveal about them? To, you know, what quotes do they say? Who do they quote from? Who do they don't? Again, you know, and that's trying to have it feel real, not just be outlandish. But again, there's also there's, you know, to the editing process, there was one character that our editor very smartly advised we get rid of, frankly, because they were a little bit too vanilla and boring. And so they didn't make the cut. You don't have to worry about them. But, you know, at the time we were like, how could you say they're boring? That's the way this person—
Our characters, give them back. And yeah, but you have to let them go.
But that's the way this kind of person really is in the real world. And they were a DC-based person.
Yeah. Well, no one in DC is ever boring. I don't know what you're talking about.
One more thing too. I mean, I think the characters inhabit different worlds, and you see the war from different perspectives. But I think, you know, there's technical realism and there's sort of the narrative realism, and there's a lot of bad stuff that happens to our characters. I mean, you know, fundamentally, they go through very trying experiences, and some of them don't come out well. And I felt like that was an important aspect of this, that this wasn't to be a story where it had a nice bow on it at the end, because that wouldn't quite resonate.
Yeah. I mean, so we were before this podcast talking about, time it. I just saw the Jurassic World last night, which is a, you know, great movie, enjoyed it. But one of the comforting things of it is at the very start, knowing that, you know, all the key characters are going to make their way through it. There's no concern that the two little boys are not going to make it. Sorry, spoiler alert, but I think you kind of—
Spoiler alert, it's basically the first movie all over
which
again.
Which doesn't make it bad. Yeah. But the point is, you know, there's a certain kind of thing, you know, things that you know will happen, we hope for ours that there's certain moments where you you didn't know this was going to happen, or a character takes a certain different step because of the things that happened to them, and that's, you know, part of making sure that it feels like a journey. And again, that reflects the real world. We've seen this, you know, when we try and understand why nations do certain things to why politicians or generals. We're often looking at these, you know, certain moments in time, these certain decisions that they make that can lead them down fundamentally different pathways. And that's one of the things that we play with here. And yet, while that's happening, that ability of humans to make choices to reshape the world, there are other things that are happening that there's no changing them. And so one would be, you know, the pace of technology. Clearly, the technology, so my last books, the way we use robotics in 1998 and 2014 is not going to be the way we use them in 20XX. Sorry, that is reality. And yet that's a hard conversation to have. You know, and the weird thing is, or wonderful thing is, we've used the book to actually brief groups like the Defense Science Board on how to envision the use of robotics in the next war, except to go back to the footnotes, it's not just, oh, we dream them up. It's, hey, guys, here's the different use cases for autonomous systems, AI, and robotics in battle. But we didn't come up with them. Each of them is documented from programs that you're already funding.
Right. So when is the Ghost Fleet movie coming out?
I think it would be a great video game, too. You know, I think there's a lot of different... characters you could play.
And, are you allowed to discuss if this is even a negotiation yet, or are you going to pass on that one?
We're going to, you know, go the War on the Rocks front of, crowdsource it, and maybe you'll be our sponsor.
Just give me the rights to it.
Then I guess we have to write a character. And, you know, there's no character who's an editor or a journalist.
That's fine. They'd probably die pretty early on. Well, this was great. I really appreciate you guys joining the War on the Rocks podcast. And, I'm sure this book's going to sell very well. The link will be on the page as you're watching this podcast. Please go out and buy it and read it this summer. It's actually really fun. I have to say, I didn't think I'd enjoy it that much, and it ended up being a lot of fun. So great job, guys.
We really appreciate it. And one last add-on that might be fun and appropriate for this venue is there's a website for the book, ghostfleetbook.com, but it also, among all the reviews and all that other stuff, it has a music playlist where there are certain, you asked about the writing process, there are certain songs that either we listen to or were inspired by certain characters, and it even has the page number where you might play that song be appropriate. So definitely check it out. It's a lot of fun.
So you can put that playlist on your iPhone and listen to
That's
it while you're at the beach.
And we're also working on a beer list as well for the beach reader.
Well, we do have to do something, some sort of Molotov cocktail thing on War on the Rocks related to this, of like what different characters' favorite drinks are or something like that. So
perfect.
Let's revisit that. But thanks again for joining us, and thanks for listening.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks.